Nick, great to see you again. Welcome back to the conversation with me. We've done a lot of stuff in the past, but thank you for being on Tattoos, Code, and Data Flows. Why don't you give the audience a little background on yourself so people can get to know Nick a little bit better?
Yeah, hey, Matt, it's really great to see you. It's always fun to hang with you. I'm Nick Sinai. I'm a senior advisor at Insight Partners, a large venture capital and growth equity firm investing in software. I'm adjunct faculty at Harvard Kennedy School, and I'm currently working on a book due out in September called Hack Your Bureaucracy.
Oh, awesome. Sounds like you're a busy guy with all those things. Those are very different type of activities, from VC to, professor to author. I mean, where do you find time for all this stuff?
I like to say that I've failed in academia, I've failed in industry, and I've failed in government. So you learn a lot through failure. So I've been in a variety of sectors and a variety of roles, and it's been fun. And so, I try and bring some of those lessons to each domain. The most important thing, of course, is family. And so, my 9-year-old girls, are undefeated in now 4 games in soccer. So that was the important weekend activity. Coaching soccer.
That's the same thing. I have the same thing with my older daughter in softball. So it's all the time, go, go, go. But yeah, being there for those events, mine's a senior in college and going to be gone pretty soon. So I enjoy those moments is all I can say.
But you look like a spring chicken.
I don't feel like a spring chicken anymore. The gray in the beard's getting more, so the back's starting to hurt, but we can still make it work. So why don't we jump into this? This is section Thinking Out Loud to understand what Nick's thinking out loud about.
Thinking out loud, maybe we found love right where we are.
I'll give it a little bit of context. I went to a Harvard Business School and MIT Defense Forum the other weekend. And so it was a lot of fun. I saw some of my students there. There were officials from the Department of Defense there. And so it was a fun conference. And there was a lot of talk about emerging tech and innovation and how the Defense Department needs to do a better job of trying, buying, and scaling these technologies. And so that's really what's on my brain, because I'm also on the board of 4 companies, Rebellion Defense, Shift5, Leo Labs, and Hawkeye 360. And they all are focused on the national security, either in full or in part, that mission set. And so this idea of how the Department of Defense buys from what they call non-traditionals, called venture-backed startups and scale-ups, is really on my mind. And so it's something that has been, it is key to not only, the Insight portfolio companies winning in this space, but the entire sector, right? There's a number of venture investors who have made investments in cybersecurity, in AI, in a variety of different spaces. Because the Department of Defense has said that it is increasingly open to these kinds of next generation technologies, mostly software companies.
Yep.
The Department of Defense has got to do a much better job here. And so that's what's on my mind.
I thought that the government was very easy for companies to sell into the government and roll out very quickly. I thought this was it must have been a short conference. Isn't it an easy thing to do?
Yeah. It's a piece of cake. No, I boil it down to two problems. If I can summarize, one being all of the bureaucratic crud, that's a scientific term. Whether that is going through the security accreditation and getting something what's called an authority to operate, which is kind of getting the formal permission to be on network or in the cloud, the DoD's version of the cloud, right? Those kinds of things. Whether it is getting your facilities clearance, so actually getting permission to look at classified information, all of those kinds of bureaucratic processes. Each one may individually make sense, but collectively, when you put them together, it just puts a tremendous tax on young companies coming in to serve the Department of Defense. So that's kind of problem one. And problem two is we have a lot of innovation funding. We have a lot of R&D funding. So that's actually not an issue. But when it comes to operational buys, to scaling, there's an old maxim of the DoD doesn't have an innovation problem. It has an innovation adoption problem or a scaling problem. So those are the two things that I think we need to do a better job of if we're going to really modernize the department for the kinds of what they call strategic competition. Right, we've moved away from counterinsurgency being the primary focus to thinking about strategic competition with China and also Russia, as the current conflict in Ukraine points out.
Oh, very good. I mean, hopefully that was educational to me. So hopefully it was to the audience as well. So now here's your chance to get on your soapbox and tell you what really ticks you off. This is our rant session.
I got a lot of problems with you people. You're going to hear about it.
So Nick, it doesn't matter if it's DOD, if it's something with your teaching activities, writing a book, what takes you off these days? What is the thing that you're really aggravated with?
I'm aggravated on how hard it is to hire in government. So just as context, I had the privilege of spending 5.5 years in the Obama administration. A lot of my students enter government after the Kennedy School or Harvard College. And I'm passionate about technologists and everybody doing a tour of service in government. I think it's an important way to give back. I think it's important to serve your country. And so I want to encourage people to do that. And yet we make it so hard for people to do that, right? And so it's not really about the pay cut, but it is about, you know, how can we reduce the friction and the time to hire? And so it's just, it drives me crazy how difficult it is when someone has raised their hand and said, you know what, maybe I'm coming out of a graduate program. Maybe I'm an entrepreneur and I've had an exit. Maybe I'm a mid-career developer or security professional, and I want to go spend a couple of years and help my country. You know, the CISA, the cybersecurity agency in DHS is hiring like crazy. And it's still really hard for them and other government agencies to hire. So we got to do a better job of reducing that bureaucratic crud, making it easier for government to attract and hire. Because people, once they raise their hand and say, I'm interested, you know, aren't going to wait forever. They have other options and they move on, right? They don't just, they're not in this kind of indefinite waiting period.
Yeah, it's interesting when people want to help and the, you know, just process gets in the way of helping, and you know, time is always fleeting, and for somebody to have that opportunity and something else pop up, I could definitely see that as a challenge. Do you think it's just the bureaucracy or the pay scale that's kind of the big gap there? I mean, or is it both?
Yeah, I mean, the pay scale doesn't help. Although there are some authorities for in certain fields like cybersecurity where people can be paid more, sometimes even considerably more. So we're doing better on the pay scale. We're never going to have the RSUs or the options that kind of have the outsized wealth creation. But that's okay. You know, the mission makes up for that if you're talking about a finite time period. You know, and the stability of the career and the meaningfulness of the work for some people, you know, they're happy to give, you know, 30 years to the public sector. But for other folks, you know, doing a tour of 2 or 4 years, you know, even at a reduced income relative to the private sector salary, that really isn't the issue. The issue is all of the other pieces that make it difficult. And so whether it's your security forms, whether it's how you apply, all the processes to actually get on board. And then once you get working, you want to work in a modern environment, have access to modern tools. All of those kinds of things add up. And those are things that government can control. It's harder to change the pay scale, but you can control time to hire, kind of the modern working environment, all those types of things. And so that's where we're making some good progress, but we actually got to do a lot more.
Very good information. Thank you for that, Nick. So now here's the exact opposite. It's Nirvana World. And if you had a magic wand, had 3 wishes, what would it be to fix, you know, a certain aspect of the industry? I mean, you kind of talked about easier to hire, but what would be the thing that you would fix if you had, you know, omnipotent powers to do so?
Well, I would scale early career hiring, frankly. And so I'm proud to have helped on a new program called the U.S. Digital Corps. So this is a 2-year fellowship for early career folks in the federal government, and it includes a cybersecurity track, but it also has a data analytics and digital services and product tracks as well. And so that's actually going to start this June, there'll be a number of fellows, these 2-year folks, who come in to federal government for 2 years, and then hopefully some of them will stick around. But we need to massively scale that kind of initiative because when you kind of get back to, well, what's the root cause of some of the challenges in modernizing government, talent is always top of mind. And I know that sounds funny for someone who works with a number of software companies. You think I would go right to technology and we got to adopt more SaaS and cyber and et cetera. But actually, talent is so critical to this. And starting at the early career technical pieces of it, where government traditionally has not done a great job, you know, with some exceptions, I think the intelligence community has focused on that a lot better. But so that would be, if I was king for a day, I would massively invest in early career technical hiring in government.
Oh, that's a great program. And I assume something like that already existed, but I guess not. And since you're in the trenches, you probably know better than most of us.
Yeah, it's there have been other efforts to get early career folks in, but not one. This is the first one focused specifically on digital and cybersecurity talent. You know, we're able to pay more than the kind of standard entry pathway into federal service, but we need to keep working those authorities. We need to keep working some of the hiring rules so that we can really, you know, make it an option. You know, people go into consulting, they go into big tech, they go into entrepreneurship, they go into you know, Fortune 500 companies. There's all kinds of things that people do coming out of undergraduate and graduate programs. And we want to make for technical graduates and technically skilled folks, including people with alternative, you know, restarts, boot camps, whatever. We want to make federal service another option.
Oh, very good. No, that was a great section. Thank you for the information. So now we're going to move into the speed round. Actually, I'm very excited about the speed round because you're the first DOD government expert we've had on. So a lot of the questions that I ask are from the lens of the public sector or private sector, I should say, with, you know, software companies or, you know, people that are dealing with the commercial side of the house. But some of these questions are very, I don't know, subjective in nature. So I'll just hit you with them and then give me your take with your DOD or your governmental hat on, if you will. Does that sound good?
Okay.
All right. So in the DOD or government, is it referred to as DevOps or DevSecOps? Or are they the same thing? What does DevOps or DevSecOps mean in, say, a DOD setting? I mean, what's the appropriate term?
Yeah, I hear DevOps a lot more than DevSecOps in government. But you also hear a fair amount about how security needs to be integrated everywhere. So it wouldn't surprise me if government starts using DevSecOps. I think one of the things that's frustrating is sometimes government uses the word DevOps wrong. And the reason is because there's this culture of acquiring or building software and then separately maintaining it or deploying it. And sometimes they'll use DevOps to essentially mean agile software development in terms of, you know, sprints and more rapid capability, but still having a more traditional test or a more traditional production that is divorced from that development environment. So that's one confusion that government sometimes gets into. And the other confusion that they get into is the word operator means something different in Department of Defense. It's, you know, you think about a Navy SEAL or you think about special forces. So sometimes when you talk about an operator and operations, folks get a little confused. As your listeners know, operations is about the operations of the software in production, not the what we call the end user or the customer is also called the operator in DOT speak.
Oh, gotcha. I mean, yeah, we live in a world of acronyms meaning the same things, terms meaning different things. It's you always have to put a definition next to everything just to make sure everybody's on the same page. All right. So in the governmental space, you know, everyone talks about shift left. Is shift left still a thing within government agencies, both, you know, civilian agencies or DOD? Is shift left really talked about? What's the take on shift left or the usage of that term within all of these different agencies or groups?
Yeah, you do hear it in government, and I think it's still important to be shift left. I mean, you and I have talked about this over the years, and I like your take on it, that might actually be the wrong way to think about it. And we have to be thinking about this throughout the life cycle a bit more, not to put words in your mouth.
Yep.
But the other thing that the government is particularly interested in is this idea of a software bill of materials, right? And so trying to understand where software came from. And so that's been a focus of a recent executive order. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, is working on some voluntary standards setting efforts in that arena. So it'll be interesting to see where the government goes with the, as they call it, the SBOM.
Yep.
But that's been one particular focus. As it relates to really getting developers to build code securely, you see that where the developers and engineers are inside of government, right? So I'll give you an example. In the Department of Defense, there's a number of what they call software factories. And so this is where government is building its own software. And in that case, there absolutely is a focus on shifting left. But sometimes, actually, most of government software is built by the large systems integrators, the primes, they're called. And there, they are told to shift left, or there's the requirements to build secure software. But it's unclear kind of how much shifting left is really happening in those environments. At least it's opaque to me outside of that ecosystem. Maybe hopefully it's more clear to the program buyer or the customer inside of DoD just how securely that development is happening.
Now, do you feel that shift left challenge is different for the private sector or commercial sector compared to DOD or civilian agencies? Is it a different problem or pretty much the same, just with different steps?
No, I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's the same. There may be different acronyms. There may be we may be further behind in many respects in how government both builds and buys and integrates software. But the same concepts apply, right? I hope that government learns from your listeners and from you on application security and how we can do all these great techniques, whether it's understanding the posture, whether it's scanning the code, whether it's red teaming, all these kinds of things. And Insight Partners has investments in all these different arenas, including a number of great firms. I'm passionate about those companies being adopted by government, because I think that's important to building more secure software.
Gotcha. No, great stuff. So who do you follow, like, to educate yourself via social media, via blogs, via whatever? Who do you look up to in the industry that, you know, you think has, you know, kind of a good hold on things, a good understanding, and help you understand from a day-to-day perspective your responsibilities? Is there a person or a group that you follow? Who do you actually follow?
You mean other than Matt Rose?
I'm blushing. I mean, can't you see? That makes me feel good. Thank you, Nick. But someone more smart, a little smarter than me. Not more smart. That just shows you how such an idiot I am. But there you go.
No, so I do kind of read the trade rags and LinkedIn and all that kind of and various other things on Twitter. But I would say that the stuff that I follow the most closely are the entrepreneurs, the CEOs, the technical founders and CTOs of our companies. And that's where, I mean, these are people who have lived the problem for many years, in many cases have been in the industry 20 or 30 years. And so listening to them about how they're thinking about the problem, what they're seeing, what they're doing, what their vision is for the product. That's one of the best ways that I get educated about the whole field. The other thing that I try and do is spend time talking to CISOs and CIOs. And so listening to kind of how they see the world. Mm-hmm. And so those are two very different sides of the same coin, right? Because, you know, entrepreneurs tend to be optimistic and trying to paint a vision of the future. And when you talk to CIOs and CISOs, I'll give you an example. I was talking to one of a civilian agency last week who was saying, you know, I have too many cybersecurity tools and we're only getting 20% capability or usage out of any one tool. And I would rather us rationalize and use tools to, you know, their full capacity and platforms to their full capacity. And so I've heard that now from several CIOs and CISOs of how do we start to rationalize the cybersecurity tools that they've already bought and get more out of them, integrate them better, automate them. And it's fair. Like if you come into an organization and you suddenly see 30 or 40 tools and the question is, well, can we get down to half of these? If you really believe that you're going to improve security by doing so. And I think there's an argument to be made of the complexity of tool implementation may actually not serve the security goals of your organization.
Oh, great stuff. And then final question. I mean, this is passionate to me and my kind of why I get up in the morning. Have you heard about application security posture management or ASPM and how it's becoming kind of the new technology to help find risk in production applications? Do you know anything about it or just curious?
No, so I am not as deep in this space. I'm excited that Insight has recently made this investment in your company. And so I'm super fired up about how this applies both to commercial industry as well as public sector or government customers, because I do think that getting that visibility into your applications is getting visibility into anything is challenging for executives. And so I can only imagine that getting visibility into your application security across the different types of applications and what they're actually doing would be super helpful. But please tell me more.
No, you hit the nail on the head. It's really about finding, you know, things you don't know exist, and based on the complexity of applications and aggressive CI/CD pipelines that everyone tries to find all the vulnerabilities, but with constant change comes constant unknown. You just don't know what you don't know. And that's what we're trying to help organizations is truly understand what the risks and what the architecture looks like in your production environment. And, you know, I'm really excited that, you know, we potentially can work together again and go and do the things we did in the past, talking about, you know, a new technology and a new way to do things that make people more secure, whether that's in the private sector or the public sector. So,
you know, Matt, one of the things I was thinking about in just reflecting on some of the CTO and CISO and CIO conversations I've had in government is that they have a variety of different applications from big mainframes to cloud-based solutions to kind of low-code build apps and everything in between, right?
Yep.
And so the complexity of things is also magnified by the fact that some of them are built and maintained by folks inside their organization, but many are built and maintained by government contractors, these systems integrators.
Yep.
And in those cases, they have their own pipelines, right? And their own production environments. And so trying to get visibility into security, both in tools and environments you own and tools and environments you don't own, ultimately you're paying for and are delivering, you know, mission value for you, right? So it's a very close working relationship. Sometimes you can influence or outright dictate some of the security tools they use, or at least ask them to perform certain types of scans or whatnot. So when I think about the one of the use cases for application security posture management inside of public sector would be to potentially we can go have some conversations and figure this out is whether understanding the government owned versus the contractor owned development environments, and understanding the security posture of both of those, and whether you might have more holes in one or the other. And I don't know the answer to that, right? You may think, well, the contractor is going to have more problems, but you might actually find that you've got more challenges in your own shop. But that's one potential use case I think could be pretty interesting.
It's kind of a litmus test for the third-party contractors too. Like, they tell you something, but is it really what they're telling you is the truth? So it's kind of giving you the full record of architecture rather than trusting somebody to tell you it's the right thing, if you understand where I'm going there.
Totally. And we struggle with being a very paper or digitally paper and documentation heavy security compliance culture in government. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to move to more data rather than documentation, and more continuous red teaming. Yep. rather than just auditing. So that's kind of the cultural shift. And I imagine that you all could fit into that, of being able to actually prove something rather than just take documentation sake for it.
Awesome. Well, now it's my chance to answer some ask questions that I think the audience would like to say. So this is the expert witness.
Your Honor, I move to disqualify Ms. Vito as an expert witness.
Can you answer the question?
No, it is a trick question.
So Nick, this is an opportunity for a lot of people to learn from you. A lot of people haven't had the experience being part of the Obama administration. What was that like? You know, everyone kind of deals with the commercial space or certain entities, but actually to be on the executive staff in a important role, what was that experience? What did you learn? What were things that you'd like to share or can share? I don't want to, step on any toes or pass out any confidential information, but what can you tell the audience about that experience, and, good, bad, or indifferent? I'm fascinated.
Well, it was a huge honor to serve in the Obama White House for 4 years. This may surprise some of your listeners, but the White House is actually a bureaucracy unto itself of several thousand people that sits atop a massive bureaucracy of several million people, the U.S. federal government, the executive branch anyway. And so, one of the things that we quickly learned was that you really had to be entrepreneurial if you wanted to have impact at scale, because there's so much collaboration and so much checking and socialization around anything new. This is true in any good-sized organization. Is building momentum is super important, right? Writing it down simply and being able to share that across a lot of stakeholders, super important. Making things easy for the other person, super important. Finding ways for other people to take credit for your initiative, that old Harry Truman saying of, you can get more done if you don't care who takes credit. And of course, the old Winston Churchill, don't waste a crisis. and we had a few of those. The meltdown and subsequent recovery of healthcare.gov actually led to the founding of a new digital unit inside of government called the U.S. Digital Service. So all these lessons of really trying to find the right problem to work on, understanding how organizations really make decisions, how to experiment, build some momentum, how to build a team, how to scale, using more jiu-jitsu and judo rather than karate. So how do you use the bureaucracy's motions against itself? All those kinds of lessons, not just stories of me and my co-author, Marina Nitza, who is the CTO of the VA, but we also tell those of our fellow bureaucracy hackers and put them in this new book coming out September called Hack Your Bureaucracy.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I know. I think that's a lens that people just don't see or that they're curious about. So coming from somebody that's been there and lived it, I think it's great value to the audience. And hopefully they got as much value out of it as I did, because I always like to talk to you about your experience in the Obama administration, because I just find it fascinating to actually be on the inside and doing these things that affect pretty much everybody in the country in some way, shape, and form.
Well, I'll tell you about that some of the lessons that I learned and my co-author Marina learned the hard way are totally applicable to your listeners in just about any size organization. And let's face it, we all either work in a bureaucracy or live alongside a bureaucracy. It could be parent teacher association, a homeowner association, local school board. It could be your employer, your school, your house of worship, whatever. There are bureaucracies exist because there's got to be standardized ways to do things. It's fundamentally a more efficient and fair way of organizing activity at any scale, right? And so, how you start to make progress, regardless of your role or team, is something that I think is super relevant. The fallacy that I think we all fall into is that we're waiting for our boss, or we're waiting for the CEO, or in our case, the leader of the free world, the president, to kind of come down on high and say, this is how we're going to do things, or this is the change that we're going to make. And what I've seen both in growing software companies where, I'm working now, but I've also seen this at Harvard University, and I certainly saw this at in the U.S. federal government, is that you know, those kinds of reform initiatives and big pronouncements made by leaders often codify and accelerate existing change and existing reform and existing momentum inside of organizations. That is, rarely does a leader say, hey, we're going to go do this, and everything kind of flows down. It tends, you know, when there is a movement, when there's change, when there's pressure internally and externally, that's when a leader can announce a big initiative, whether it's a reform or a new start or whatever the thing is. And so it really is up to you to kind of get started, regardless of where you sit in any organization. And then you can kind of build the momentum for your CEO or your division president or whoever to kind of launch a big initiative or celebrate your success.
Oh, awesome. No, thank you for that. And thank you for answering the questions. I know that's a very prideful time of your career. So I just wanted to get it out there and help people learn a little bit more. So let's move into kind of the social aspect of the podcast.
Now he's getting a tattoo. Yeah, he's getting ink done. He asked for a 13, but they drew a 31.
So this is basically the tattoo question. People like this one. It's very interesting in the private sector. A lot of technologists are all into alternate styles and tattoos and stuff like that. I mean, you know, I'm self tattooed myself, but dealing with the venture capital community or dealing with the governments, I mean, how do you see people being accepted for expressing themselves? Is it something you see, or is it taboo? You got to cover it up. Just curious that somebody may want to go into one of these sectors and, you know, maybe it has to cover up or not cover up a certain tattoo or whatever. What do you see in your dealings across DoD or private equity type activities?
Well, I mean, look, there are plenty of people in venture capital, in certainly in the companies that we fund, and in government that have tattoos, right? And so I think of someone like Shannon Sarton, who ran the digital service team at HHS. She had a great shoulder and set of tattoos that were visible. You know, she'd go to conferences and you could see those. And that was just part of her identity. She brought her whole self to work, which I thought is fantastic. I believe Jen Easterly, the new head of CISA, I believe she's got some as well. And so like these it's interesting that you see this more with women leaders these days in government, but there is an increasing acceptance and celebration of bringing your whole self, and for many people that includes tattoos as well.
No, that's great. I mean, I'm happy to see, because everyone thinks of, you know, you mentioned the White House, you think very, you know, stuffy, top notch, yeah, buttoned up, suits all the time. Everyone, you know, talks, you know, in proper English and doesn't swear at all. But it's good to know that there's actually human beings and the ability to express themselves, and even in government or in private equity.
Yeah, you've clearly never spent any time with Rahm Emanuel. There's plenty of swearing inside of any White House of any administration. And look, you know, folks are professionals, but they also are human beings. And so my wife has a tattoo that she got on her first date. Was not with me. Okay. but she, you know, she got it when she was 19 or something like that. Yep. And so you know, I think I prefer I'm an old school Jew, so I don't have any tattoos myself. But I, you know, it's just a thing I think of, at least my generation or the generation before, about just kind of that hesitance towards tattooing. But I'm all for people who want to express themselves with body art. And I just prefer they don't put their previous boyfriend, you know, or anything like that. It doesn't have initials. It's an Irish, I think like a four leaf clover, something like that. So it's not too bad.
Excellent. Well, thank you for being so honest with that. I really appreciate it. So this is the closing time.
Closing time. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
So Nick, this is your chance. You get to, you know, plug your book or anything else you want to that's coming out. I mean, this is your soapbox to kind of, you know, plug something you're passionate about to the audience, you know, and the floor is yours.
Yeah. Thanks, Matt, for having me at this fantastic podcast. It's always great to see you. As I told your listeners, I'm really passionate about how do you get more done. So check out Hack Your Bureaucracy. It's on Amazon. You can pre-order it. It is something that I've been working on for the last couple of years, with some great stories from the White House, from Google and Amazon, from small companies and other organizations. So excited for the book launch in September. And more importantly, I'm excited to work with you again now that Insight Partners has invested in Bionic.
Oh, awesome. So the book is due out in September. It's not out yet.
It's due out in September, okay. But pre-orders count.
Absolutely.
So you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, search for Hack Your Bureaucracy by Marina Nitze and Nick Sinai, and okay. You'll find it there.
Awesome. Well, Nick, it's great seeing you as always. Thank you for being a fantastic guest and providing a totally different lens on Tattoos Code and Dataflow in terms of content. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we can do this again in the not too distant future.
Thanks, Matt. Great to see you again.
Thanks, Nick.